Ha ha. Welcome to another episode of the Choose Your Soul Show. My name is Hakeem.
My name is Alyssa.
And we are passionate about our purpose in providing perspective and resources to help you choose yourself and strengthen your soul. Now, soul is an acronym for self, optimism, understanding, and legacy. So go ahead and subscribe, share, double tap, send to your friend, invite your family in so we can expand the collective and get this growth together. Every week, we got a special guest to help you GYM, and that's Grow Your Mind. This week, we got an open-heart surgeon who finds time for family and fitness every time, Mr. Puya Hamadi, y'all. Round of applause. All right, now. I ain't playing with you. Now, when you give love to yourself, you also receive love. And when you are the source and the receiver, then it is the purest form you can transmit because ain't nobody messing with it on the way to your heart. Think of a gold miner at the pawn shop versus a newbie at the pawn shop. The gold miner plays with gold every day, so he can't be fooled. The newbie has no idea what gold is, so he just buys whatever he's told is gold. Same way with love. So love yourself, choose yourself, and strengthen your soul.
Hi, Puya. Thank you so much for being on. We're so excited to talk to you. How are you doing today?
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Better every day.
Amazing. So, okay, you're an open heart surgeon, right? And our first question is, what led you on this path? Was there something specific in your upbringing or how you were raised that made you want to go down this path? And what made you decide to be a heart surgeon over everything else? You know, there's so much in the medical field that you could have went down. How did you get here, essentially? Tell us a little bit about your story.
Yeah, so my dad and my grandpa were both surgeons. So I was, you know, brainwashed at an early age. But, you know, obviously I had those two amazing role models growing up. And I saw, you know, their interactions with patients, you know, how fulfilled they felt. They both worked very hard and they were gone a lot. You know, my dad was gone a lot when I was growing up, but I saw how amazing their impact was and some of the interactions that I saw between patients after the fact and how fulfilling their job was. So I kind of went down that path, got exposed to it. And then I actually started out thinking I would be an orthopedic surgeon because I was an athlete. I was a personal trainer. I interacted with orthopedic surgeons. I thought I'd be like the team doctor for a professional sports team and do sports med. But then I, you know, met some mentors along the way in med school, both cardiologists and cardiac surgeons, that I just saw that, you know, cardiac surgery to me seemed to be kind of the most fascinating, the most challenging and kind of high risk, high reward specialty. Every specialty kind of has its own benefits and they all do amazing work. But, you know, the first time I saw an open heart case, that kind of really like made me think, okay, like this is what I got to do. And you know, it's been difficult. It's been challenging. It's got its ups and downs, but I couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Damn. Cutting people open to save their life. That's a big amount of pressure, I feel like. How do you deal with that, the pressure?
You're right. You know, lots of pressure. Obviously, I think, one, you just have to get comfortable under pressure. So people who are not comfortable under pressure, surgery, and especially cardiac surgery, is probably not a good fit for them. But just like, you know, an elite athlete or, you know, somebody who is a pilot or an attorney in a big trial, there are just certain people that either thrive under pressure or at least appreciate that and like the challenge. And it was difficult. You know, when I first started, I was terrified. And there's still times now that I am, you know, uneasy because I'm in a difficult situation. You know, when you got someone's chest open, heart stopped, and you got to make sure that heart stops back up and in a good way, it can really take its toll on you. And I think that's probably one of the, maybe sometimes the negative aspects of my job sometimes, is that there is a lot of pressure and it can weigh down on me during a difficult case. But how I deal with it is, you know, trusting the process, trusting the training, and not being afraid to ask for help. You know, the ego can get in the way sometimes. And I think the sign of a good surgeon, especially early on in their careers, like me, I'm early in my career, is that I'm not afraid to ask for help. And I have really supportive, excellent partners that, you know, I picked my first job because of them. And I wanted to be somewhere where I felt supported. And I have a very low threshold to ask for help because I think the people who have too big of an ego to ask for help, those are the people that kill people. Man, I don't want to be one of those people. So I do not have an ego that'll prevent me from asking for help. So that's how I deal with it, is I'm not afraid to, you know, rely on other surgeons, cardiologists, my assistants for help. And then how I deal with it outside of work, it might sound cliche, but exercise. It's like the one thing I do for myself. Every day I go to the gym after work, no matter what it takes. I go play some basketball, 30, 40 minutes, hoop, and then go and lift and stay healthy. And it's my time to shut my brain off unless they call me from work. Then, you know, it's just that's how I decompress. Staying fit, and then, you know, making sure I'm not on an island asking for help.
Yeah, no, that's it, man. Trust the process and your training and ask for help. AF, how do you deal with pressure? I mean, you know, how does your spiritual discipline build your confidence when dealing
with pressure? I think asking for help can be applied to any profession in any area, because especially if you're, like, for me, I'm building a business, right? So if I need help, I'm going to outsource what I need to do, asking for help, asking people for support. Or when it comes to spiritual growth, I outsource my, if I need insight on any specific thing that I'm working on, I'll reach out to, you know, I have like a whole group of people that can help me with insight, like maybe seeing my blind spots that I can't see as I'm growing. Because a lot of the times, like, I just had this kind of ego death in a way where I didn't realize my subconscious was like suppressing all these memories, because my ego is like hiding all these memories. And I was doing some work, inner work with my psychics and stuff. And they were like, okay, you have this stuff coming up. Did you ever think about this? Do you remember these memories? I was like, holy shit. Like, I totally just they weren't even part of my aura at this time. But because I was doing the work with them, they started to come up so I could remember. So it's interesting.
No, that's it. Definitely asking for help, but teaching others too. I found that to help me, you know, stay humble and really touch base with the basis. Because if you're like, for fitness, for me, I dedicate to my growth and fitness, what I'm learning, my research, my application, my reflection, my body every day. And then when I get a new client, I have to go back to the basics. Do you find that when you're teaching others that you know, revisit the small things that you might already have habitually implemented and you don't pay attention to on a day to day?
So, you know, one of the things that we always hear about in our training is that to be able to truly show that you understand an operation or a disease process, you have to be able to teach somebody else how to do it. So even when I was a trainee, like when you're a senior resident or when you're a fellow, if you can take a junior resident through a case, that's kind of how you know that you have, if not mastered, at least you understand it. Because it's one thing for you to be able to do it yourself, but it takes the next level of mastery and comprehension to be able to teach somebody else how to do that. And so now that I'm an attending surgeon, you know, being able to help my assistants, you know, walk through parts of a case, or, you know, I'm a consultant for device companies where I go out and I, you know, teach fellows and other surgeons how to use certain new devices in arrhythmia surgery. That's how I know I actually, you know, understand this stuff, is that I'm able to teach other people. And then when I go out and teach other people, I learn new stuff. I mean, there's times where I, for example, you know, for one of the device companies, there's, you know, a clamp for arrhythmia surgery that I'm teaching a surgeon how to use it, but that surgeon's way more experienced than me. It just so happens that I'm teaching them how to use something, and I'll learn some new stuff from them. You know, I may know more about that clamp, but they know more about the actual cardiac surgical aspects of it or the anatomy. And I'll actually learn stuff while I'm teaching. And that's why, you know, medicine's amazing, is you can literally teach somebody and learn in the process of doing it and grow your level of confidence, mastery, and knowledge.
Yeah, man. Work on your stress capacity. The most successful people have the ability to manage stress, because we all fucking manage stress. I mean, we all deal with stress, depression, and anxiety. But the goal is to not let the stress make you depressed. And how you do that is you increase your capacity for stress. And how do you do that? Repetition and confidence, meaning simulate controlled struggle every day for Puya Fitness, right? Where you're trying to push your body past, when I'm tired, I still push through those boundaries. Or, you know, other people can put themselves through a simulation of a open heart surgery. Do you guys have open heart simulations?
Yeah, we do a lot of both dry labs and wet labs. So pake hearts that we connect to cardiopulmonary bypass and actually have blood running through them, so it seems like you're actually operating on a heart. Dry labs where you have heart models, 3D printed models. So we do a lot of that because it's high stress, high risk work. And you don't want your first time being on a live patient. You don't want your first time, you know, being in that kind of environment. If you're operating on a pig heart and you screw something up, that's the time to screw it up, so that when you're in the real deal, you know what you're doing. And then going back to your point of stress management, I mean, I think whether you meditate or you do yoga or something as simple as, for me, like if I'm in a bad spot, like if I'm in an emergency, I will literally just take one or two deep breaths. And I know that's like a very, there is a lot of science behind taking a few deep breaths to increase that kind of parasympathetic nervous system, to reduce that catecholamine surge. And, you know, you're in fight or flight mode. If you see somebody dying in front of you, and you got to, let's say, crack a chest open emergently, reopen a chest in the ICU, you have an emergency case and you literally are running a code and someone is dead and you got to make sure that they're not dead. I mean, that's when my own heart rate is 180, you know, and I have to stay calm, right? If I'm running a code and I'm all over the place and I'm scatterbrained and I'm yelling and I'm screaming and I'm out of control, everybody else is going to be out of control and that patient's not going to make it. So a lot of times if I walk into a code situation, I just stay quiet, observe what's going on, look at the monitor, look at the patient, get information, and then I just take two deep breaths. Like I'm taking all the way, like diaphragm all the way down, full deep breaths, get my heart rate down, try to stay calm, and then proceed. And I do that in the operating room. If I'm in a difficult spot in the operating room and things are not going well, I'll just literally take just two deep breaths and it'll just reset me. I will notice, I'm very in tune with my own heart rate. I will notice my heart rate go down. I'll notice myself relax a little bit. I'm still stressed, but at least I understand about, you know, being in control of the situation to the best of my ability. And I may not, you know, come out on top in that situation, but at least I do it in a calm, reasonable fashion instead of yelling and being all over.
That makes sense that you're aware of your heart rate.
Yeah.
No, I agree with the breath work in general and just understanding your own breathing and how it can regulate your nervous system. You need to have that regulated nervous system. And I will die on the hill. I talk about breath work all the time and just really using your breath to bring yourself down when you are up a notch or in every situation. It's so helpful. People don't use it enough.
Yeah. Or even in situations where, like, let's say somebody screwed something up and like, I want to yell at them. And then like, I might react, and we're such reactive creatures. You just, as you're reacting and you realize that you don't need to yell about this, even though something bad happened, like we can fix this. I'll sometimes in the operating room, just take a couple deep breaths and be like, hey, listen, I'm sorry I yelled. It's a high stress environment. I just need you to communicate better with me next time. And I think that's how you don't alienate people. That's how you, you know, realize that it's, you know, team-based effort, and I make mistakes, and they make mistakes, and we're so reactive as creatures. Somebody cuts you off, you yell at them. But if you just remember, like, if they cut you off, take a deep breath, maybe they're having a bad day, maybe they're late, maybe they didn't see you, then you can, you know, not be so reactive. And sometimes taking a breath just allows you to do that. And instead of reacting 10 out of 10 times, you might only react 2 out of 10 times. So, you know, that helps me out a lot. In the operating room, if somebody screws something up and it's people's lives on the line, you know? Sometimes I feel like I need to yell at them, and then mid-yell, I'm like, oh, wait, hold on. Like, it's fine. Like, don't, it's going to be okay. Like, just next time, don't do that. You know, ask me before you touch that or do this, you know? And it helps me stay calm instead of, you know, being super reactive.
Put the motherfucking scalpel back, please. Please put the scalpel back. Do not touch her titty again until I get the heart out. Why he's touching her titty? No, but the space, what gives humans their uniqueness is the space between the stimulus input and the response. It's not instinct. Yes. We have the ability to choose. And to increase that space, meditation, you know, exercise, cold shower, breath work, fasting, sprinting, these things that put space between I'm going to quit and I'm going to keep going. And the more you push through the excuses and the threshold, the more space you have to make a choice between what comes in your stimulus and what you're about to do. And the deep breaths give you more time in that space, because the initial emotion is like, boom, if I'm going to do it, hold on, let me wait 2 breaths. And that gives you time to process the emotions. And I've noticed that to help me too. They've been telling me that since I was little, because I was an angry little motherfucker, but I didn't listen until life made me sit my ass down. So work on your breath work. How can people work on breath work?
You just have to start. I mean, yeah, when I, you know, people say breath work, we have to breathe every day to live, obviously, but actually there's different techniques that you can do. And there's, if you Google it, there's so many different, Wim Hof's a good one. Yeah. Like, just follow them, follow their lead, follow the guided breath work. That's a great way to get started. And then I was just doing it right before our call. Like, you'll learn how to do it on your own to get those really, like you were saying, the really deep diaphragmatic breaths are what really does it to help you regulate that your system. So you just got to do your research and find out what works best for you, because there are different types. And if you're somebody who's never done breath work before, like it's like, it can be pretty intense afterwards. And so it just, you know, start small. You can do like 5 minutes and then go up from there or whatever. But there's a lot out there that you can find.
Do you have in the medical field a way to measure someone's stress capacity or fitness capacity?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to measure it. So like, we actually do what's called a stress test on the heart, where we'll put you on a treadmill and then have EKG leads and echo, and we'll actually see how your heart does in terms of with stress. There's VO2 capacity and VO2 max testing, which basically it's the same thing that, you know, you do for an elite athlete, but when you do it for a patient is to see, you know, what's their cardiopulmonary fitness, so their heart and lung fitness to be able to undergo a different type of operation. So there's a lot of ways to measure, you know, functional capacity of the lung, of the heart, of just your overall fitness. And it just depends on the purpose of what you're doing. Like if you're doing heart surgery and you want to see if somebody has heart disease that's only presenting itself when you stress them from a physical way, you can literally do, you know, bike testing, treadmill testing, or you can actually give people medicine that imitates that they're exercising if they're not fit enough or they're too frail to get on a bike or get on a treadmill. So we do a lot of that in heart surgery pre-op workup to see, you know, how things work. And then on the lung surgery side of things, we do a lot of that to make sure, you know, you have the capacity. Like if we're going to remove part of your lung for lung cancer, we got to make sure that the remaining lung is fit enough for you to be able to breathe appropriately after surgery. So if you need a really extreme operation, like where we're taking a whole lung out, we got to make sure the remaining lung on the other side has enough functional capacity in terms of exchanging oxygen and blood flow to it that it'll be able to cover you. Because, you know, a healthy person can get one of their lungs removed and be just fine with one lung. But a person who smoked for 40 years and has COPD, bad lung disease, may not be able to tolerate a full lung coming out, you know, for let's say an advanced lung cancer operation.
Do you think, well, obviously you are passionate about fitness and you find a way regardless. We talk about, me and Puya been boys since, man,
over a decade now.
Yeah. We've been brothers, man. And he always talks about fitness. We always connect on a fitness level, and he'd be busting his ass for over a day straight and still find a way for fitness and family.
I fallen asleep at the gym before. After a 36 hour shift, I went to the gym. I fell asleep on the bench.
36 hour shift.
Yeah, I went to the gym because I knew if I went home, I would just go to sleep and not go. So I went to the gym and I fell asleep on the bench.
That's dedication, man. Quick power nap. Hey, don't underestimate the power of a nap either. For real.
Okay, that's so good.
Because I'm ready to go back for another 36. But yeah. What about the fitness level of your colleagues, other surgeons? Is there systems in place to see if surgeons have the capacity to deal with those situations before they even get in the room?
Yeah. So there's physical and there's mental. I mean, I think I'll be honest with you. I've seen physicians who are not in good shape. I've seen physicians who don't take care of their own health. And that is a problem. But also you got to kind of see where it happens, right? It starts a lot of times in training. So in training, we are working. I mean, there's an 80-hour work week limit, but there's people who work more than 80 hours a week. So there's only 168 hours a week. And if you're working more than 80 of them, there's not a lot of time for sleep. And, you know, we work, you know, 28-hour call shifts. And if there's stuff going on, if the clock strikes 28, it's not like Cinderella, I'm going to turn into a pumpkin at midnight. Like, I'm going to stay and finish the work. So there's times where you're in the operating room and I'm not going to walk out of a case in the middle of the case. So you might be there 30, 35. If you're on home call and you get called in every night, you might not sleep for 3 nights. And so poor sleep, not, you know, you don't have time to eat healthy. So, if you go into a hospital cafeteria, it's a mess. I mean, they're serving pizza and burgers. And I mean, if that's what they're feeding the patients and the surgeons and the doctors, I mean, what do you think? How are you supposed to feed patients appropriately? You tell patients to eat healthy when they go into a hospital and they see that kind of stuff. So I'm very, you know, outspoken on that. Every time I see any of our C-level executives, I'm like, we need healthier options here. Like, why isn't there either a vegetarian option or salmon or lean chicken, at least in the surgeon's lounge? Like, come on, like in the doctor's lounge, why do we have all this fried stuff in the doctor's lounge? I mean, this is insane. So I think poor diet, no time for exercise, poor sleep, and then stress. I mean, the cortisol levels, the stress response when you're in training, it was very common to see people come in as medical students in pretty good shape and finish residency 5, 6, 7 years later in not good shape. And, you know, I don't have kids. The people who were in my program who were married and had kids, I mean, it's really hard to expect them to work 80, 100-hour weeks and be a good father or mother and be a good husband or wife and take care of stuff and do research and do work at home and prepare for tests. Oh, and also go work out every day. So I get it. I understand. I mean, like if I had children, maybe I wouldn't have been able to go to the gym every day, you know, because you want to prioritize your children. You want to spend time with them when you get home, make sure you put them to bed. So it's just tough. It's tough to take care of your own health, and you got to make it a priority. So that's the physical part of it. And then again, I think, you know, I do see physicians who are out of shape, and it's unfortunate. I've seen personal trainers who are out of shape. I've seen physical therapists who are out of shape. I mean, I've seen nutritionists and dietitians who are out of shape. So it's just, you got to kind of know your own limits, focus on the things that you think are important to you. And then from a mental capacity, I think that's a little bit harder. I mean, obviously, you know, your performance is very closely watched. So if there's a surgeon, for example, that does not have the mental capacity to do something, I would imagine that, you know, the assistant or the anesthesiologist or somebody might notice. And, you know, there is no like cognitive testing right now for surgeons. So if, let's say, you're of a certain age and you start noticing that something's declining, like, it's on the honor system of you and then obviously observers for you to understand that, hey, maybe it might be time for me to give up the big cases. Like, I might need to stop operating, but I can still do like teaching and like administrative work. Goes back to our political situation right now, right? Like, we have a 78-year-old and an 81-year-old running for office. So should there be...
That's why I don't vote y'all. Fuck them.
It's like, should there be cognitive testing to, you know, run a country or do open heart surgery or, you know, be a pilot? So, you know, I mean, we're not going to get into that over here. You know
what it is. Wild out here. We're just talking about that. How many hours do you personally work a week, do you think?
It's variable. And training, I worked a lot more. I mean, there were weeks, you know, that I don't want to say out loud because I'm supposed to only be working 80 hours, but there are weeks that you are in the hospital more than 80 hours a week, 100 hours, 110. As a staff surgeon, it just depends because I'm a little bit more in control of my schedule. So if there's a, you know, I typically, you know, go to work early in the morning, 6:30. My first patient's in the OR at 7 o'clock. You know, average cardiac surgery case takes somewhere between 3 to 6 hours, depending on what kind of case you're doing. Some cases take longer if they're more complicated. And then you got to go see your patients. Sometimes I have clinic in the afternoon, see consults. But like an average day for me is kind of 6 to 6, you know, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., 5 days a week. So, you know, 12 by 5, 60 hours, like that's a normal week. But, you know, I'm on call sometimes. So last Wednesday, I was in the hospital 2:30 in the morning. And then I had to go back, you know, a couple hours later and get the day started. So it's very variable, but I definitely work a lot less, you know, now than I did in training.
Okay, if you're out here and you're listening to this and you work less than 80 hours, make sure you go to the gym, keep on say.
Yeah.
You have the time.
No, because health is wealth. You know, when you use, you know, food as medicine, then you won't have to use medicine as food.
And shit, hey, you better take preventative action.
Yeah, listen, I mean, honestly, I'm not trying to be facetious, but the vast majority of the people that I operate on, I'm talking open heart surgery, stop the heart, do heart surgery, and then bring the heart back. This is invasive stuff. The vast majority of this is preventable. I would be unemployed if people went to the gym, ate healthy, and took care of themselves. I mean, yes, bad genetics for sure. There are people out there who are marathon runners that have coronary disease. I get it. But I'm saying the vast majority of patients that I operate on are in that position because of lack of preventative measures and lifestyle changes. So not smoking, the biggest thing you can do for your health is not smoke. Beyond that, you know, healthy diet, Mediterranean diet, and exercise, you can prevent a lot of dementia, lung disease, heart disease, cerebral vascular disease, meaning prevention of strokes. And most of that is lifestyle stuff. Not all of it. Like I said, bad genes, you can't fight bad genes, you know, all the way, but you can fight it somewhat. You know, if you have familial hypercholesterolemia, which means, you know, you have genes that your cholesterol runs high, with appropriate medical treatment, with a statin, you know, following up with your doctor, checking your levels, exercise, eating right, you may be able to avoid coronary disease that needs open heart surgery, coronary bypass surgery. So, I mean, especially in America, you know, we don't take care of ourselves. And then we have a, you know, like a whack-a-mole healthcare system. You know, you don't take care of yourself, some problem pops up, whack it, surgery. And then you don't take care of it, so another problem pops up, whack it, medicine. Whereas if you just took care of yourself, it's inevitable. You're going to have health problems. You're going to have, you know, genetic stuff. You're going to have, you know, illness with aging. But I promise you, I wouldn't need to do this many cases. I guarantee it.
Would you say that smoking is the number one reason why people get open heart surgery? Or what's the main reason people come in for that specific surgery?
Top three.
It's multifactorial. So, you know, the most common open heart surgery that is performed as coronary artery bypass surgery. So that's, you know, basically coronary artery disease, blockages in your coronaries where you need to bypass the blockages. some people can get stents, but when it's more advanced disease and multiple vessels, when the heart function's down, you know, those patients benefit from open heart surgery. So coronary bypass surgery is the most common. And the things that cause the risk factors for coronary disease are all the like common sense stuff. Smoking, being overweight, high cholesterol, lack of exercise, you know, diabetes. And again, if you have diabetes, it's okay. If you manage that diabetes well, your risk for needing open heart surgery, having stents, or having coronary disease comes down. But if you have unmanaged diabetes, then, you know, that's going to lead you to have coronary disease that needs some work done. So it's all the common stuff. I mean, like keeping your weight under control, checking your cholesterol, taking a medicine if you need to fix that, staying active, keep maintaining a healthy weight, not smoking. I mean, these are all like huge preventative measures that could prevent most of coronary disease, dementia, and other risk factors for chronic illness.
And if you know it runs in your family, stay away from that shit. Don't be fucking playing with your life. If your mama and your daddies are smokers, don't smoke. Both mine are smokers. I don't smoke. There's diabetes on all kinds of freaking sides of my family. And so I manage my sugar intake. Large part of my dad's side is overweight. So I stay in the gym. My genetics might have given me my frame, but I didn't maintain my frame from my family. It's been 34 years since I was born with these genetics. I maintained it by taking the proper actions to capitalize on the genetics that are good and stay away from the ones that are bad. If you got diabetes in your family, what you eating chips and damn sugar for? And just to wait until you crash over and die?
A good thing to get in the habit of doing is just looking at food labels. You know, sometimes you might grab an iced tea out of the fridge in the doctor's lounge and you look at it, it's got 40 grams of sugar. It's supposed to be iced tea. It's supposed to be healthy. It says it's healthy. It's sweetened tea.
Natural. Sure.
Don't drink that. I mean, look at the back of the other day. I was in the surgeon's lounge and I saw that there was like the coffee machine was out of order. And I went to grab it was a Dunkin' Donuts iced coffee drink. And I grabbed it. It had 34 grams of sugar. I didn't drink that. You know, look at the anything that's in a wrapper. Look at the, you know, label. It's got sugar. It's got fat. Unhealthy fat. You know, if it comes in a wrapper, you should probably be weary in the first place. But you know, we gotta live. And so, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can get into talking about intermittent fasting. I mean, I only eat one meal a day, but that's just because of my lifestyle. I eat lunch basically. That's the only meal I have, and then the rest of my meals are basically protein shakes. And I'm not saying that that's right for everybody, but it works for me, and I'm fine with it. I don't really have time to cook, and I don't have time to go grocery shopping and all that. So I eat one meal a day, and the rest of my intake is basically protein shakes and, you know, meal supplements, and that's fine. It works for me. I'm not saying it works for everybody, but you got to look at what you're putting in your body. Like, read the labels, you know, all the artificial sweeteners, all the high sugar drinks, all the energy drinks, that stuff's not good for you. So if you're, every time you put that in your body, understand that you are doing some harm. And if you, you know, do it here and there, it's fine. But if you do it every day, if you're having red meat every day, if you're eating fried food every day, like, I'll see you soon.
Yep. Hey, I told you, 80% healthy, 20% fun, 100% happy, and life can't be redone. And make sure you got the systems in place to replenish and recover. Make sure you have it in your routine to hydrate, sleep, get nutrients, exercise. Otherwise, if you don't have time for those, like you're going through school and shit, then you should really be mindful about your consumption because you don't have the ability to flush those toxins out. And a lot of times, well, for the gut nowadays, there's a couple people on that I've had conversations with where all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they can't even eat. They can't even eat because they get bloated or they get tired or they get hives. They can't eat anything. And that is after you've eaten so much bullshit, as the toxins increase in our foods, you know, our threshold for being able to consume gets shorter and shorter. So now you got 40, 50, 30-year-olds who are going through these hunger pains where they get bloated from small shit and random shit, this one bite, and your gut is at its capacity. Now, every time you put something in it that's fake, it's like, hold up. Same way with the heart, I'm sure. You can smoke and drink and sugar, but once you hit that capacity, you're gonna get some signals. Your skin's gonna fuck up. You're gonna get some fat cells. You're gonna get out of breath. You're not gonna be able to sleep. Pay attention to those, because eventually it's gonna shut the fuck off and you're gonna go to Puya.
And, you know, I mean, jokes aside, the reality of it is that eating healthy is expensive, right? So like organic fruits and vegetables are a lot more expensive and difficult to prepare and eat and obtain than just grabbing something with a wrapper or fast food. And so that's an innate problem, right? Like if you don't have the time and the money to go to Whole Foods and get the nicest ingredients, you know, you're at a disadvantage. But there are ways around that, you know. I mean, you could go find a plant-based protein supplement or, you know, a protein meal replacement thing and use that if you don't have the time to eat healthy. And it's fine if you want to eat fast food every once in a while. It's fine if you want to have a steak every once in a while. It's all about moderation. Same thing with alcohol intake, right? Like any alcohol is bad for you. That whole myth of, you know, alcohol can be healthy for you in low doses, that's starting to get disproven. So I'm not saying don't drink. I'm saying be responsible with it. I've had patients who have had, you know, they drink, they smoke, and they use drugs, and we're trying to get ready for heart surgery. I don't expect them to all of a sudden cut everything out. I'm trying to be reasonable. I mean, they have a critical heart problem. They can't wait for a year for them to revamp their whole lifestyle. So I'm realistic when I see them. And I am not exaggerating. I've literally told the patient before, like, I know you're probably not going to quit smoking before we do this operation because you have, you know, the type of coronary disease that can wait for a couple of weeks, but not a year. And I literally had a patient that I was like, you just need to stop smoking crack. If you just stop smoking crack, I'm serious. If you can stop, like, we literally negotiated, like, if you can stop smoking crack,
smoke cigarettes.
He was like, I'm not going to stop smoking weed. I'm not going to stop, you know, smoking cigarettes. But I was like, at least quit that, because then that is a good start. I'm wrong.
It's a great point.
But like,
to everyone.
I try to be realistic, you know, or I've had patients that are just like, it's too hard for me to quit smoking. And I'm like, well, I can't just not operate on this person. Like, I got to get them through it. So I said, well, let's try to cut down. You know, how many cigarettes are you smoking a pack a day? Can we try a half pack a day? Can you come see the smoking cessation clinic? Can we try, you know, patches, gum, something? You know, if your BMI is 60, you know, can I send you to a bariatric surgeon afterwards to discuss this? I mean, it's very easy for us healthy people to sit here with the resources that we have and be like, everybody needs to stop smoking and eat healthy and eat organic. And, you know, there are people that just don't have the capacity to do that time-wise, finance-wise, health literacy-wise. So you got to meet them where they're at. So my nurse practitioner looked at me like, did you just tell this man to keep smoking everything else, but just like,
what is his time?
He needs heart surgery, you know? So if he stops that, we're good with the rest of it. Like, we'll one thing at a time. Like, it's the same thing in the gym, right? When I used to be a trainer, people would come in. The most important thing you can do is set goals. And the goals have to be realistic and consistent and objective. You can't come into the gym if you've never been to the gym and say, I want a six pack and I want to run 5 minute miles. You got to be realistic. You say, okay, I want to get my BMI from 30 to 28 and I want to spend 30 minutes 4 days a week. And I want to focus on this, this, and this. Objective piecemeal goals.
So. Yeah. I was just going to say, when it comes to ingredients too, I mean, I feel like people sleep on Aldi. They have really good, cheap, organic stuff that you can get. I love that. It's owned by the same people. Did you know that? Fun fact. Right. And there's this app called Yuka, Y-U-K-A, that you can scan, like, anything, any barcode. Doesn't work on produce, obviously, but it will tell you the rating of, like, what the ingredients are in whatever food you're buying, and then it will give you better alternatives. So just a little fun fact if you want to use that. It's really crazy.
Yeah. It's just little steps, you know?
Yeah. Let me tell y'all, I was never addicted to crack, okay? But my daddy was for a long time. He went to treatment 14 times before he went sober. Now runs a sober house for 14 years. My mom was addicted to partying and liquor, okay? I've been addicted to partying, liquor, fighting, pussy, sugar, weed, cigarettes, vapes, black and milds. I've been unhealthy. There is light, y'all. I ain't addicted to none of that no more. I might dabble in some pussy, okay? I might dabble in some fried food. I might dabble in some sugars, man. I might take a shot and turn up in Vegas, but I will not neglect my foundation and what got me to this healthy stage to go back and start doing fun shit that is so far away from who I want to be, then it becomes detrimental to your family. Like, I fucked up my day. Oh, my morning was slow. Okay, let me get back to it. That's cool. Get back to it. But once it's like, damn, I skipped work. I didn't pick up my kids. I spent all my money. Well, those are all signals for change.
Moderation,
baby. How do you manage your emotions and mindset when you have to deliver bad news to a family?
Yeah, they don't teach you that very well. You got to just figure that out on your own. But, you know, there's just certain principles. Do it in private. Don't, you know, find a room. It's just you and them. Sit down, be sincere, be honest, give them time to process. You know, we do our best, but we can't save everybody sometimes, and it's devastating. But you just give that news, and you got to communicate and be honest and be upfront, and then give them time to process. And sometimes they won't know what to say. Sometimes they won't have questions right out the gate. Sometimes they'll get angry, and you have to just deal with that. So those are some of the tactics to communicate, and then you have to deal with it. One of my mentors told me that every cardiac surgeon carries a graveyard with them to their own grave.
Damn.
Do you have the ability to do that? You know, and so we all remember our bad outcomes, and it's hard to deal with that night. It's hard to deal with the next morning. It's hard to go back into surgery the next day after something like that. But it's resilience, right? The same way an athlete can miss a game-winning buzzer beater and then strap up and go play the next game and perform, you got to do the same thing. You know, you can't let something from the past impact the future aside from learning from it. So if you made a mistake, then you learn from it. If the situation, you did everything you could and it was a bad trauma or it was a complicated case, an emergency that just didn't go well, then you understand that you did everything you could and you learned from it, and you review your, you know, every mortality, and should be every program, gets reviewed at like a morbidity mortality conference so we can all learn from mistakes and poor outcomes and making sure that everybody's doing well and holding everybody accountable, you know. So that's what you do. You know, you just got to move on. And there are ones that hurt. You know, when I was in training and you saw a kid that, you know, after heart surgery that didn't make it, I mean, that will mess you up pretty good. Dealing with the parents, delivering that kind of news, I mean, that will mess you up. And that's the kind of responsibility you have to inherit and take on and be open, honest, and then just move along.
One mindset that kind of helps me stay humble, accountable, and in control is when something goes good, it's we did it. When something goes bad, it was my fault. Because then you're in control. When you say we did it, it keeps you humble and it lets you understand that it's not just you. Even if it is just you, you got God with you. So, and you got your past experiences of every relationship you've ever encountered that developed this mindset. So it was a we thing. And whenever you deter from that authenticity or from the goal is planned, it's for us to be able to be resilient. It's like, okay, like you said, let's reflect. Let's see what went wrong. Now let's get right back in there and fix that now, not let too much space, you know, too much time lapse between the mistake and, you know, the next plan of action. Because I think that's where a lot of depression can come from. Have you had colleagues go into depression after, you know, making that mistake, I guess, or experiencing that situation?
Yeah, I mean, there are times when, you know, people mentally, you know, struggle. I think, you know, programs need to be able to offer resources. If you need to go talk to somebody after you see something like that, you need to have your own self-awareness to realize that maybe you're struggling and to seek help. You just have to have your ways of going through it. You know, one of the things I do, like if I have something that happens, whether it's an emergency or a bad outcome or something like that, I'll just keep replaying it over and over in my head. And to a certain extent, that's healthy, right? It's like, could I have done anything differently? Like, was there something that went wrong? But then it can be intrusive, you know, at times. So you just got to keep that at bay, whether it's talking to one of your colleagues. You know, one of the things that me and my colleagues do is if one of us has a patient that's not doing well or a bad outcome, like we just run it by each other. Like, hey, is there anything that I'm missing here? Can you come look at this? Like, why is this person not doing well? You know, like, what can we do differently? Is there something I'm missing? Is there, you know, you ask your nurse. The nurse is at the bedside all the time. I ask, every time I walk into a room, one of the first things I ask is, how are we doing? How are we doing means yep. You're here. You know what's going on at the bedside. I've been in the OR. You've been with this patient for the last 6, 7, 8 hours. Is there something I need to know? Because they're on the field. They're your eyes on the patient. So like, use your resources. Cardiac surgery is a team sport. You can have the best surgeon in the world, and if you're not communicating with anesthesia, or if the perfusionist is not paying attention to the machine, or if your assistant's not paying attention, you can kill somebody. Easy. I mean, if that machine malfunctions and there's an alarm and that perfusionist doesn't tell you, you can literally send air to the brain. It's over. Surgery's done. It's anesthesia, you know, turns off a drip of a medication that you were relying on and you don't notice. And now the patient codes, or you see that the blood pressure's tanking. That's lack of communication. It's like, you know, being a pilot. You got to rely on the rest of your team. And so that's both very scary, but also it, you know, a lot of my mentors always talk to me about situational awareness. you can't just look down. You can't just be focused on the heart. You should be focused on that most of the time, but I'm constantly, you know, I look down, I look up, I look at the monitor, I look at anesthesia. Hey, are we good? What drips are we on? Perfusion, are we good? How long has it been since I've given cardioplegia, which is the medicine that keeps the heart stopped so you can operate on it? Oh, it's been 20 minutes? Okay, well, listen, I have two more stitches here and then we're going to give it, you know, through this method. And, you know, you're constantly, in any specialty, you should be talking to anesthesia, but in cardiac surgery especially, we talk to anesthesia probably more than any other specialty. And we have perfusion, the person who runs the heart-lung machine that allows you to keep the heart stopped, isolated, bloodless, and send blood to the rest of the body. And it takes a lot of communication. It's like being, you know, on a sports team. Quarterback is constantly talking to everybody, calling a play, doing this. So, you know, I think of it like a triangle. There's a triangle between me and my assistant, anesthesia and perfusion, and we are constantly talking the entire case. And then I'm always looking up at the monitor. You know, why is my blood pressure, the mean blood pressure was supposed to be 70, it's 50. Have we started a drip? Are you giving anything in the pump? What are you doing? You know, let's put the head of the table down. You know, why is the rhythm like this? Are my pacing wires catching? You're constantly talking to make sure that you have a good outcome, because it's not just you. You can have the best operation, and if the patient goes into the ICU and they get the wrong medicine or a drip that was important gets turned off without you knowing about it, done. They go into an arrhythmia because of something, it's over. Perfect operation, it's over. So you gotta constantly, I mean, you get paranoid. I mean, I check stuff on my phone at home all the time. I wake up in the middle of the night, and I'm sitting here on Epic checking my phone, like, and I'll call somebody at 2 a.m, hey, why is this drip stopped? You know, like, why is the dobutamine off? You know, like, so you check labs. I mean, it's you just gotta be always on alert.
The communication aspect is so crucial. I think in anything that you're doing, but like, this is insane. Just, and even the sequence of events that you have to be aware of and like when things are happening all the time. Woo! Shout out to you, because that's insane.
I had a mentor of mine. One of the things that he looked at, if he let you do a part of the operation and you were alone and you were, you know, sewing her, one of the things he always looked at is, do you look, because we use loops, you know, we use magnification glasses that we're looking through and all you see is a small part of the operative field. One of the things that he would assess is, are you looking up over your loops and looking at the monitor? And are you actually doing this whole thing where you're checking with anesthesia, you're looking up at the monitor, you're looking down? And that was one of the things that he assessed. And if you weren't, all of a sudden you'd hear him from the corner go, anesthesia, is everything good? And it's like, that's your reminder. Like when you talk to anesthesia, like you're getting ready to take the cross clamp off, you should tell them, hey, tell perfusion to fill up the heart, de-air the right side of the heart, look at the monitor, what's our pressure? Have you started my drips? I mean, do we have pacing wires? What's our rhythm? What's the temperature? We forgot to tell them to rewarm the heart. Your heart's 32 degrees. You're going to fibrillate when you come off. I mean, like there's all this stuff that you got to constantly be assessing. And that was one of his metrics. He looked at how often were you looking down at the field and how often are you looking up and around and talking. It's very important.
Yeah, head on a swivel, eyeballs on a swivel. Like, yeah, damn. We have my uncle had quadruple bypass surgery. I called Puya. I'm like, yo, are you at Mayo Clinic? Because I think my uncle in there, I'm not sure what's going on. Would you perform on your family? Would that make a difference in the surgery?
You don't want to have that kind of emotional connection, because sometimes you're so worried that you can miss stuff. And I've seen this happen. I've been involved in cases as a trainee where somebody was operating on like a family friend or somebody they knew, and a critical component got missed. And then after the fact, the surgeon was like, well, why didn't anybody remind me to do this? Like, man, you're the surgeon. Like, come on. But again, I mean, the point is, when emotion is involved, you can miss things. You can potentially go into a sense of everything's fine when things are not fine. I'll give medical advice to family members all the time if they ask me for it, but I always preface it with like, you should follow up with your own doctor who's there, sees you, follow their advice. And I would never, ever operate on a family member, ever. I don't even operate on like acquaintances. Like I've had times when I was a chief resident on like emergency surgery, and I've had like an old classmate come in, or I've had one of the staff surgeons that I work with come in. I've called my staff surgeon and said, hey, listen, I can't operate on this patient. I know them. I'd be more comfortable if you did this case by yourself or use another resident, because I don't want to operate on somebody I know. So I don't do that. No, I mean, if it's like a distant acquaintance, then you're the only option by all means. But like, I would never operate on like my cousin or something like that.
Like, nope, I love you too much.
Yeah,
I have to die today.
You got to say, like, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder, out of everything, especially in this situation. I'm like, I wonder if there's other surgeons who would prefer to do it because they know they're going to do it right.
No, I would just
no.
I wouldn't do it. No, that's what I mean. Yeah, and that's the importance of building your character, because your character and understanding what's important to you, your morals, is what allows us to make that honest decision of saying, okay, I cannot be in this situation because I know my emotions will make me fuck it up. But if you don't know what you believe in as far as your self-concept and what you believe in as far as who you want to be for your future, for your legacy and your family, then when your emotions come up, it's like, oh, my mom, I want to help her. But you forgot that emotions clutter the mind. But because your emotion for wanting to help, and that's part of my problem, I had to simmer down on my mom verbally, not freaking open heart surgery, but, you know, I was so emotional about trying to help her, and ended up getting her discouraged, you know, and that's kind of somewhere I'm like, you can't change anybody. But yeah, going back to emotions, being able to identify your self-concept and your character, I think, is a big part of being aware of your emotions and emotional intelligence.
Yeah, and imagine if something goes wrong in the case, you're going to be so nervous and upset that, like, oh my God, this is my own family member, that you're going to mix, you're not right. Going to be able to remain as calm as you normally would to be like, okay, what's the problem here?
Yeah. They say the heart is the big part of spirituality, right, AF?
Yeah, heartbreak, coherence.
I mean, listen, I think one of the things that, and this may be corny and other cardiac surgeons may laugh at me, but like, I still think every day when I go in the OR, when I see that and I'm involved in that, it's still like a little bit of a spiritual experience.
Totally.
Really, I mean, it's wild. Like, what you do is wild, you know? I mean, like, every time I touch a beating heart, I'm still kind of like, oh my God, I'm like, this is actually a
damn.
I hope I never lose that magical kind of flair of it. And again, somebody might mock me for this, but like, I do think it's a little bit of a spiritual experience. I mean, to see inside someone's body, that, you know, it reminds you, like, we all look the same on the inside.
Well, you're literally holding somebody's energy, that like the life force.
Yes. And so, you know, I think it's also a big sense of relief, but after you finish the operation and you take the cross clamp off and you're trying to get the heart restarted, when it starts beating again, that's also like a very important moment. One, I'm like, thank God. Two, you know, that's like, you're happy every single time that happens, every single day. But it's also like, I mean, that's life. That's somebody's life.
Right.
It's a big deal. You know, so I never want to lose that aura and the kind of the spiritual part of that like somebody is trusting you, a complete stranger that's never met you before last week in clinic, that's like, yes, you can do this. It really is a huge privilege. And I think when you lose that can be dangerous. When you also lose the kind of that aspect of it, and again, you know, maybe somebody who's way more experienced is going to watch this and laugh at me. Oh man, wait till you do it 40 years. It's like another day in the office. But don't ever forget the why, and don't ever forget that it's still somebody literally trusting their loved one or themselves to you. And if things don't go well, I mean, that's bad. And so the level of trust and privilege, I never forget about that. You know, if somebody allows me to do that, I'm always like, okay, like, I'm honored. Like, thank you for letting me do that.
Yeah.
And those people that would mock you are the ones that have forgotten that, because otherwise they would agree with you. And everyone else besides
this, very spiritual about it. Whether somebody, you know, is spiritual, religious, whatever it may be, like I pray before every case. I pray for the outcome to be good. I pray for the patient to do well very quickly. Doesn't matter what your religion is. Doesn't matter who you call God. Doesn't matter what latitude and longitude you were conceived in, and hence what religion you belong to. Like, I pray for every single patient. Somebody can say, okay, that's futile, or you should be, you know, if it helps me calm down and if it helps me think that things are going to go better, just from a neurological perspective, it's a good thing. So I pray before every single case, and I think that's, you know, someone's prerogative to do that or not, but I think it helps me calm down and helps me kind of understand that I'm part of something bigger. And you know, it's a spiritual experience. Every time you see somebody on the inside, that's a huge deal. And seeing a beating heart still has not lost its allure to me. It's still amazing for me every single day when I see it. It's a big deal for me.
It's crazy. I've just heard so many stories about people getting heart transplants from someone who's passed away. There's a story of this older woman who got a heart transplant from a 20-year-old kid that got in a car accident and died. And then she got his heart, and she started craving his favorite foods after she got his heart. So it's just interesting how that works.
There's all kinds of stuff that we can't explain. You know, there's some stories of, you know, families that have listened to the heart in the new body of their child that they lost. I mean, the whole transplant thing is another very complicated thing. You know, with every transplant, there's new life, but then it's arising from tragedy, right? Because somebody probably had an untimely, unexpected early death to facilitate that. So, you know, when we go on procurements, you know, you sometimes they do a pause and they talk about the person, and it's a lot of times a young person that died unexpectedly, and that can really wear you down, and you got to just, you know, pay your respects and then tune it out, because it's very easy to get emotional. So
yeah, when you pray, man, just if you don't believe, if you don't know what you believe, just imagine you're praying to your future self and letting you know that you believe in yourself and you're grateful for what you possess right now, because then in the future you'll act as if you are that person. But if you neglect it and you're in your thoughts, it's hard to really identify once you get under pressure. Like, you can't just show up to the game and play. You got to practice. And if you don't do the work on your own in the off season, when you come to camp, your team's going to be like, you're slower, you're out of shape, you're weaker. And then when you get to the game, it's really going to show. So the stuff you do on your own is, you know, how you develop a character. We got some questions from the people, man. They want to know, well, I want to know too, with the synthetic and grown heart replacements, where are we with those in the medical field?
Nowhere near prime time. The kind of big thing that's been in the news, national news, over the past year is actually xenotransplant. So transplanting a pig heart into a human that's immunomodulated. That's been done twice now.
Did it work?
Well, yeah. For a short period of time. So that's happening. The problem is that, you know, if you put in a pig heart into a human, even with some modulation and with a lot of immunotherapy and, you know, immunomodulating anti-rejection medicines, it's still not ready for prime time, but they're working at it. University of Maryland is at the forefront of doing that. And then there was a successful, I believe it was a kidney from, I think it was a pig, into a human. They tried that. I don't know the outcomes of that, but, you know, that's kind of the next frontier. It's not, I think it's, that will potentially happen sooner than a completely artificial heart. We have a lot of technology, you know, mechanical support to keep a heart alive, or keep a patient alive without appropriate heart function as a bridge to getting them to a heart transplant. But we haven't gotten to the point where you can put in a artificially grown heart in yet. That's still a long time. Because right now the biggest problem is donor availability, right? There's a lot of people dying, not just hearts, lungs, livers, kidneys, because of lack of available donors. So if we can solve this problem with xenotransplant, meaning animal organ treated, immunomodulated, plus anti-rejection treatment that you're on anyway for transplant, but it's got to be a little bit stronger and maybe a little different. I'm not an expert on the field. That would be kind of the next step, I think. We're closer to that, and it's been attempted compared to like a fully artificially grown heart.
Yeah. Well, I feel bad for the Muslims in the future who are going to need a pig heart, because you're going to have to make a decision then. Do you want to die God's child, or you want to live as a living pig? Nah.
And, you know, right now, I mean, we are putting in, so like the valve I use for the aortic and the mitral valve replacement, when it's a bioprosthetic valve, meaning it's not mechanical, it's actually a tissue valve, I use a bovine pericardial valve. So the valve is from the lining of a cow heart that has been treated and then sewn onto a valve. But there are porcine valves too, that it's an actual pig valve that's being implanted in people. So we're doing that part, but that's just one valve. We're not doing, you know, full heart from an animal except for these couple of, you know, instances.
Damn. What's the relation between the CNS and the CVS?
The central nervous system and the cardiovascular system?
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, well, that's complicated a lot.
So that's two people ask the same question. So, I mean,
yeah,
that's probably why.
I mean, there's a lot of different parts in the brain that regulate your heart rate. They regulate, you know, the resistance in the vessels in terms of like your blood pressure and whether you're clamped down or not. There's, you know, there's countless different mechanisms, but obviously your central nervous system is connected both, you know, from a nervous system, electrical stimulus through nerve standpoint, but also from neurotransmitters. And so it's intimately, you know, related to your both cardiac, but also vascular. Case in point, your brain can regulate your heart rate, but a transplanted heart doesn't have that because it's completely removed and placed in. So you're not able to regulate your heart rate with your central nervous system when you've had a transplant compared to your own native heart. And for example, that's why deep breathing can slow your heart rate, because, you know, you have the breath, parasympathetic response. You can actually have a parasympathetic response on your heart and slow your heart rate down with deep breathing. That's breathing, brain, heart. Your phrenic nerve, you know, is involved, and you know, you have a lot of different areas in the heart. That your sinoatrial node is kind of the pacemaker system of the heart, and that's what dictates your heart rate. And your SA node has input from the central nervous system that allows you to increase your heart rate when you're exercising, or increase your heart rate when you're stressed out, or allows you to decrease your heart rate when you're resting, or you're relaxed, or you're meditating. So there's an intimate connection.
Well, last question. What's the most challenging case you ever handled?
Oh, they're all challenging. I think, you know, as a new surgeon right now, meaning I just finished training up about a year ago and I'm on staff, I try not to do super, super difficult cases. I mean, I sometimes end up having to. So the cases that I've done personally as a staff surgeon so far that have been very challenging are the endocarditis cases. Endocarditis is infection of the inside of the heart. So a lot of times it's either from, you know, a bad tooth infection where the bacteria gets in the blood and then seats an already structurally deteriorated valve. So tooth infections are bad. So that's why I take care of your mouth, floss, take care of your teeth, bad gum hygiene, bad heart.
Part of your gut too.
Absolutely. So there's that. Sometimes, you know, people can get like a colonoscopy and they can get, you know, bacteremia from that bacteria in their system. IV drug use, very common cause of, you know, heart valve infection. So, you know, you can get a bloodstream infection. But anyway, the endocarditis cases are always gnarly. I mean, those valves are destroyed and the infection can go beyond the valve. And so a lot of times I'll have like my partners come in and help me with those, because you need to replace the valve, but you also need to reconstruct additional parts of the heart with patches. So those are always gnarly. You know, in training, I trained at the Mayo Clinic, and there's a lot of complicated heart surgery that's happening there. So, you know, any kind of case that's a redo, meaning somebody has already been in there and it's a repeat heart surgery, everything's scarred in, those cases can be very challenging. Multi-valve surgeries, you know, and any of the pediatric cases that I was assisting with, those are always difficult. So heart surgery is difficult. There's no such thing as an easy heart surgery.
Yeah, that's crazy. Well, thank you so much for taking care of yourself and taking care of other people and, you know, giving people a second shot at life, man. That's amazing.
Thank you for having me. It's been great seeing you guys, and thank you.
That's an awesome. So nice to meet you. Thank you so much. If you listen to this and got value, this was like, I was sitting listening and learning, because it's like completely off of anything in my radar. I've never even thought about how someone like a surgeon would handle emotions and whatnot. So very insightful. Thank you. If you listen to this, if you're a listener, make sure that you subscribe and rate the episode. And yeah, how can people find you if they want to follow you? Do you have an Instagram or?
Yeah. So I'll be honest, my Instagram has mostly dog videos and funny stuff, but sometimes there's medical stuff on there. So I am on Instagram. It's dr.pouya.hemmati. So dr.firstname.lastname. I have a Twitter account. I'm not active on it. I should probably be more active, because there's the professional Twitter. I think I have Facebook. I haven't used it in a long time. But yeah, Instagram is an easy way to, you know, if you got a question or something, or if you need help with getting into medicine. I get a lot of, you know, DMs from people from other countries or people who are early on in their career that are interested in, you know, either finding research opportunities, how to, you know, get interested in heart surgery, how to find mentors, shadowing, experiences like that. So that's probably the easiest way.
Yeah, love that. So if you're interested in any of this, make sure you send him a DM. We'll plug his handle in the show notes below. So you can tap that. Yeah. And
I can't give medical advice.
Okay, so great. Noted.
I'll give generic medical advice, but not specific to your situation.
Damn. Yep. Well, I know you ain't going to be working on none of my family, so I guess I got to just stop talking to heart surgeons if I want to have some left.
No. I'm always happy to help out. You know, one of the things that's always good is, like, I'll have a lot of people that if their family member is undergoing heart surgery somewhere, they'll reach out either, you know, do you know the surgeon, or, you know, tell me a little bit more. I will say one of the unfortunate realities of healthcare is that sometimes we just don't have enough time to spend with patients. And so a lot of times, you know, what I've done is sometimes, like, one of my very close friends, his dad recently needed heart surgery. And I, like, sat him down and I said, okay, like, here's, you know, what's going to happen. Here's how it works. Here's what we do. He's obviously very in tune with things himself. So he had the cath reports and the echoes, and we went over all that stuff together. But I think it's just good to kind of sometimes hear it from somebody that you know, and I try to, you know, spend a lot of time with my patients. I draw for everybody. I draw pictures, because pictures are worth 1,000 words. I can explain to you, oh yeah, we're going to do this and that. But if I actually just draw it out for you, sometimes people can see it better. But sometimes people are busy. They don't have time. So if you have a, you know, medical professional in your family member and your family, you can sometimes just reach out to them and say, hey, listen, you know, I'm having this done, or my family member's having this done. What do you know about it? Especially if it's in your specialty, you kind of run them through some of the details of what to expect, recovery time, what to look out for.
Yeah, man. Listen, filter your senses, mindful consumption, prepare for sleep, really prioritize your sleep and exercise if you want to prevent any heart issues. And other than that, man, choose yourself to strengthen your soul.
And that's a wrap, folks. Thank you for tuning in. Until next time.
If you like it, leave a comment, share
with your friends. Yes, tag us. Choose yourself on Instagram and make sure you subscribe. Okay. Bye-bye.
Let's get it.